The Kansas Republican Party this year is seeking to continue its overwhelming power in Topeka, but in order to do so, it'll have to win what's turning out to be a highly competitive election for governor. That race features a series of candidates vying for the party nomination, including incumbent Governor Jeff Collier and Secretary of State Chris Kobach. Also on the ballot this fall are races for the State House and two intense races for Congress in the state's 2nd and 3rd congressional districts, which include Johnson and Wyandotte counties. Both could swing to the Democrats in what would be a huge blow to the GOP. The man overseeing the election for Kansas Republicans is State Chairman Kelly Arnold, and he joins us now from sister station KMUW in Wichita. Kelly, nice to have you. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Steve. It's great to be here with you.
You know, I've been pleasantly surprised, and I'm wondering if you have been, by the, you know, generally upbeat tone of this election cycle. Frankly, by candidates from both parties, you're overseeing a tough race for governor between Jeff Collier, Chris Kobach, Jim Barnett, and Ken Selzer. How would you describe the tone of the race so far?
Well, we are in our final week here of campaigning, and talked to several of our candidates and campaigns over the weekend, and they are working on their statewide tours, getting those final parades in, pressing the flesh, and working on getting their vote out. And it's been an exciting journey. I mean, many of these candidates have been in the race for almost a year now.
Yeah.
And we have been tracking and following their campaigns as they go along. And I like to brag that we have really good candidates this election cycle.
Are you pleased with the tone so far?
Overall, I am. Here in Kansas, we are used to having hard fought out Republican Party primaries. And so this year, I expect nothing different, that our candidates are going to be working very hard to attract voters to vote for them, to get their message out. And I believe they've been doing a great job on that.
I'm wondering if at some point you communicated with the campaigns about your expectations for this race and the tone you wanted to see.
Well, we encourage our campaigns to do everything they can to reach out to the voters, because part of their job is turning out the vote, getting the voters to come to the polls and not staying home. And so that is one of the things we really focus on, and they have been working hard to be able to do that, and that's something we're excited about. We're looking forward to a good turnout this primary. Overall, I believe their tone has been very, very good. They are focused on getting their message out and why voters should be voting for them.
Kansas GOP Chairman Kelly Arnold is my guest. How tough of a task do you face, Kelly, trying to hang on to the governorship in the wake of Governor Brownback's tumultuous tenure?
Well, I like to brag, since 2010, the Kansas Republican Party is 32-0 on winning statewide elections and federal offices, and we expect to continue that streak. We are very excited about the level of engagement that we have here in Kansas. We are waiting to find out come August 8th who our nominee is going to be, so we can really build that campaign around our nominee on how we need to effectively get people to come out and vote for the Republican Party ticket.
Does Governor Brownback's tenure make your task more difficult?
Surprisingly, so far it's not been a big focus, and what we've seen out there. Each candidate for governor has been sharing their vision of how we need to grow this state and move this state forward, and look to the future. And the people are listening to that. And so that's kind of what we're waiting to see who our nominee is, to see how we go forward from here.
A lot of people around the state that I'm talking to view the governor's race on the GOP side as primarily a contest between Chris Kobach and Jeff Collier, and I'm wondering if you do.
Well, you can look at some of the polls, and I don't put a whole lot of weight into polling, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
We saw that in 2014 when they said that the Republicans were going to get defeated, and that didn't happen. The major two candidates, I think, to get the most attention is Governor Collier and Secretary of State Kobach. But if you're out in the western part of Kansas, southeast Kansas, other parts of Kansas on the ground, you will see all of our candidates out there very actively in campaigning. Insurance Commissioner Ken Seltzer and Jim Barnett are very active on the ground as well. And so I wouldn't count anybody out.
Is your party going to sponsor the traditional unity breakfast the day after the primary?
So we do have a breakfast the day after the primary. And really the focus of this thing is, you know, it's time to turn our attention to the November election. Here in Kansas, so many of our elections are either won in a primary because there's no Democrat on the ballot, or we have, as I said, hard fought out campaigns. And so it's really that kickoff to say, okay, guys, you know, the primaries are behind us. We have our nominees. We're excited about them. We got great candidates. Now it's on to November. Now let's turn our focus on beating the Democrats. And, you know, we have done this election after election. And the great thing is our voters are used to coming together, getting behind our nominee and voting for the Republican Party in November. And that's what we'll be kicking off the day after the primary.
Tell us a little more about the job of a state party chairman in an election year like this. What are your job duties?
I don't know if we have enough time to talk about all that, but ultimately, so here's what we are focused on. As a Republican Party, we're focused on November. You know, we let the Republican voters in each district to decide who our candidates and who our nominees are going to be. But we lay out that groundwork. So once we have our nominees, that they have an infrastructure that they can tap into on the ground in the grassroots aspect of things. You know, I'm focused on raising money to make sure the party has the resources we need to get to our candidates and that. But there's other tasks. You know, we have to make sure we have a strong party infrastructure, make sure our delegates throughout the state are actively engaged in campaigns. Our precinct people are out there working. And there's the other aspect of a lot of times I like to say I wear a referee hat, you know, and mm-hmm. Help work with the different candidates, especially in these very contested primaries, on, you know, how to best navigate things, especially when one candidate does something and another candidate wants something and help them keep the focus on making sure they win their own campaign.
You know, what about this idea that the Republican Party at the state and federal level is split between Trump loyalists and moderates who don't like the president's approach? How does that play, Kelly, into Kansas state politics, and does it complicate things for GOP candidates here?
Sure. Fortunately here in the Midwest and specifically in Kansas, President Trump continues to have a strong approval rating, on his agenda.
But it's not
agenda.
What it used to be.
Well, it's still strong, and if you pay attention to our candidates, you're seeing that most of our candidates are all vying for his support, whether that's on a governor's race or on one of our federal races. So sticking with the president is going to be a smart thing. We've seen that across the country in some of these other races where he has gotten involved in. That a lot of the candidates that he has supported have won. We are excited about the agenda that he's put forth and the economic aspect of it and how that has really been playing out. So that's something we can run on.
Do you expect the president to endorse any of the candidates for governor? You know, obviously, Secretary of State Kobach has particularly close ties to the president. Do you expect anything to happen between now and Election Day?
You know, I've been asked that quite frequently lately.
I bet.
And all I can say is you never know what President Trump will tweet out. So I do not know if he will get himself involved in the governor's race or not. I would not be surprised either way.
He hasn't called you on this, it doesn't sound like.
If he did, I don't think I have too much influence over him.
All right. Well, the president today and yesterday is talking about a government shutdown if he doesn't get his border wall. What does that do to your blood pressure?
Well, anytime you talk about shutting the government down, it makes you nervous. You got to look at, you know, what is the benefits and the negatives of it. And that's something I'm looking at. I think a lot of people are looking at. We know how important it is to get some of these border security items passed in Washington, D.C. to secure our borders. So we are for that aspect of things, but you never know how a government shutdown is going to play out. If it does, my suspicion is, you know, the Democrats are going to again take the blame for this. They attempted to do this a few months ago, and the American people were very upset with the Democrats on this. And, you know, that quickly they quickly resolved that.
But certainly a government shutdown with the Republican Party so firmly in charge in Washington, that wouldn't be something that a state party chair out here in the Midwest would want to see, is it?
Well, I mean, ultimately, we're going to have to see, you know, what they try to pass and or don't pass, and how that would play into a campaign narrative. You know, nobody wants the government shutdown. Sometimes it may be worth it to get to get that border security to make sure, you know, our people in America are protected. So, you know, we're going to be focused on our Kansas issues, what's going on here in the state and how we can make Kansas better.
You know, a question closer to home here, Kelly. Kansas State Senator Barbara Bollier, who represents a district in northeast Johnson County, recently endorsed a Democrat to replace Representative Congressman Kevin Yoder in the U.S. House. She was stripped of a series of committee seats in response to that endorsement. Was that the right move by Senate President Susan Wagle, who's also a Republican?
Well, I can't speak specifically for the Senate president. What I can say is you kind of broke a cardinal rule by endorsing Democrats, and this is not endorsing dog catcher. This is endorsing in a governor's race and in a federal congressional race. The Republican Party actually has you know, part of their bylaws that we can strip. If you say precinct people or state delegates do that, remove their powers from doing that. We want our Republicans to stay focused on electing Republicans.
Does Barbara Bollier's move signal a split in the Kansas GOP between the traditional argument between moderates and conservatives?
No, nothing that I've seen that is new. You know, our Republican Party is obviously the by far the largest party here in Kansas, and we have people that represent all different aspects of the Republican Party. I mean, not just you know, social issues or fiscal issues, but you're talking urban to you know, out in western Kansas issues. And so we have a vast number of types of Republicans. And ultimately what we do is we let the Republican voters in their districts decide who best represents them. And then we turn around and focus on making sure Republicans win in November.
Kelly Arnold is my guest. He's chairman of the Kansas Republican Party. Who do you want to face in the general election when it comes to a Democratic opponent for governor here? Laura Kelly, Carl Brewer, or Josh Swatty?
You know, I'll let the Democrats try to figure that out. Right now, I believe that, you know, any one of our Republican nominees would be able to defeat the Democrat in you know, whoever they select. And of course, you also have independent Greg Orman that's going to be in the mix. And so, you know, this is a new strategy for us on navigating a campaign where you have, you know, three major candidates on the ballot.
I was going to say this is a new wrinkle in statewide Kansas politics, at least at the state level. Greg Orman ran for the U.S. Senate a few years ago. How does that change the math here? And does it help Republicans or does it hurt Republicans?
You know, we'll have to look at the data once the election's over with. But, you know, if you just initially look at it, you sit there and think, OK, you have Greg Orman, who's trying to run as an independent. However, he in 2014 was the de facto Democrat Senate candidate. You know, he was somebody that went out and campaigned for the Democrat vote, went out, raised money from the Democrats and received money and received the vote from the Democrats. So I think the Democrats are going to be in a position, OK, do I cast my vote for the nominee of Democrat who probably isn't going to be that well known, or do I cast my vote for this Greg Orman who, you know, I voted for before as a Democrat? And so I think ultimately it's going to be pulling votes from the Democrats. He'll try to reach out and try to get some independent votes as well. But if you just historically look at the numbers, our Republican voters are gonna stay with the party and with our nominee.
I should point out that Greg Orman, the independent candidate, a few months ago picked a Republican to be his running mate. Maybe in response to what you're saying there, Kelly.
Well, I think he has to work overtime to try to reach out to Republican voters, and I don't know whether he's going to be able to successfully do that. You know, we'll really start paying attention once the primary's over, and you know, again, you know, it's up to our nominee for governor, and you know how they put their campaign together, so we can focus on you know, reaching out to our Republican voters and getting them out to vote based on that.
Do you expect an independent candidate for governor like Greg Orman, do you expect him to be competitive in the race? Or I think some early polls have suggested that might be something of a reach. What kind of support you think is there for an independent candidate in a state like Kansas these days?
You know, we're really built on a two-party system. And so, you know, it's going to be very difficult for any third party, whether that be, you know, a libertarian or reform or green or independent, to be able to get a significant amount of votes. But what it will do is it will pull votes from, you know, potential the Democrat nominee. And so it will play out, you know, I believe, into our benefit. But I don't expect Greg Warman to get much over just double digits on this race.
We got a phone call here from Scott from Roland Park. Scott, welcome to Up to Date. Good morning.
Hi. I wasn't going to call because I figured what's the point in calling a Republican. But when the gentleman said that Trump threatened a government shutdown over his stupid wall, and then he says that's the Democrats' fault. Now, explain to me how the idiot president can say he's going to shut down the government, and that's the fault of Democrats.
Scott, thanks for the call. Kelly?
Well, I think it's ultimately, you know, are we able to get the votes to support funding, border security funding? And if the Democrats, I know Republicans are going to be there. And so if the Democrats are not willing to come to the table to even negotiate this, you know, I mean, they're just a party of no.
You don't expect unanimity from the Republican Party on the border wall, given how controversial that wall is, do you?
I expect near that. You know, can you get 100% of anybody in any party? No.
Right.
But we will get, you know, super majorities of our Republicans on the table. And you know, border security and the security of our nation should be, you know, a priority for everyone, no matter what party they are. And what I fear we're going to see is we're going to see, again, time after time, Democrats not willing to come to the table to even start negotiating, you know, some type of bill that would get us in that direction.
How tough of an issue is immigration right now, though, in a state like Kansas, Kelly, where industries, particularly in the western part of the state, have come to rely so heavily on immigrants and rely on that labor supply? How does that play out in western Kansas these days?
Well, I mean, immigration, you know, will affect every state. And here in Kansas, you know, we are, you know, halfway across the United States as far as the border goes. And we have a number of immigrants that work here in Kansas, and we welcome them. We just want to make sure that there is a legal path for them to come here and be able to work and reduce the illegal immigrants. And, you know, specifically, you know, the biggest concern is the drug trade that has, you know, been brought north from the southern parts, you know, such as Mexico and that kind of thing. And so that is a top priority, I know, for many of our voters is that.
I wanted to ask you about your party's decision to establish rules that effectively kept one of your candidates for governor, Jim Barnett, from participating in debates. Jim is a former state senator. He's a medical doctor, and he was your party's 2006 nominee for governor. What about that?
Well, just quickly here, when the idea of debate started, we had many of the candidates running for governor come to the Republican Party and say, hey, is there any guidelines? Is there any precedent that we need to expect for debates? And we offered, you know, the National Republican Party had taken over debates, set some guidelines. You know, we'd be willing to do this if you as the candidates are willing to do this. And they were. We went to every candidate, including Senator Barnett, and said, hey, you know, we are willing to facilitate this. This is your guys' agreement. You guys come up with what you would like to see in here, and we will work it out. And that's exactly what we did. We took the input from the candidates and put together an agreement. We reached out to Jim Barnett many times on what he would like to do or what he'd like to see, and he just from the get-go did not want to participate. And,
well, the criticism of the system that you guys set up was that it was sort of a patty cake set of debates, you know, questions offered from party members, if you will, as opposed to journalists. And Jim Barnett decided not to engage and agree to that set of rules, and the result was a major candidate for governor couldn't participate in debates.
Well, we had four very successful debates, and you know, we didn't interfere with other forums and that kind of thing that took place across the state, which I know he has participated in many of the forums, many of the chamber, livestock, farm bureau type forums. And so, you know, his voice has been able to be heard at those forums as well. And you know, this is something we reached out to him multiple times to be a part of. We welcome him after every debate. We went back to him and or had some type of conversation about participating in future ones, and it just didn't work out.
Just finally, I want to turn to races for the House of Representatives, the State House of Representatives this fall, Kelly, because all 125 seats are on the ballot. Your party gave up some ground and lost seats in 2016. I know there's a big push from conservative interests to oust moderate candidates in your party primaries this August. How do you see that playing out? How big a push are conservative backers making right now?
Well, we did get all the way up to, I believe, 97, 98 House candidates out of 100 – or electeds out of the 125, and you kind of look at that pendulum, and, it, you know, you can only kind of get so many. We expected that that would pull back, which it did that last election cycle. You know, this election cycle, you know, we've been monitoring and just kind of watching how things are playing out. You know, I don't think there's as many contested races as there have been in the past. I think these candidates and campaigns have been a little bit more focused on, you know, the specific districts where they believe they might be able to win. But we're excited. We have a lot of great candidates.
But are we seeing an intense internal fight right now play out in these races for the House between conservatives and moderates?
My answer is no. We have a number of candidates that have a few different you know, visions on what they would like to, you know, how they'd like to see Kansas move forward. But you know what we have seen in the past, you know, go back to 2012 and others. You know, I don't think we're nearly on that scale.
A real final question here: do you expect Kansas Senator Pat Roberts to seek another term in the U.S. Senate in 2020? And I should point out, Kelly, that he would be 84 on Election Day in 2020 if he does so. He's already suggested he's going to. What do you expect to happen?
Hey, another million-dollar question.
Yes.
You know, Senator Roberts is doing a fantastic job for us representing Kansas and Washington, D.C. You know, he's focused on trying to make things better for us. I have not sat down with him and had that discussion. We're still a few years off. You know, I think we'll all be waiting at the edge of our seats to find out whether he's going to run for another term or decide to, step back.
That's Kelly Arnold. He's state party chairman for the Kansas Republican Party. Kelly, thanks so much for your time. I sure appreciate it.
Absolutely. Great to be here with you this morning, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk trade and tariffs. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Last week on the program, we learned about a local university's plans to introduce a varsity esports team. It seems video games are becoming a ticket into college for some students. Hear more at kcur.org/uptodate. And we're 8 days away from the August primaries. Tomorrow on the show, learn about the election issue central to Jackson County and the race for Jackson County Executive. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, speaking in Kansas City last week, President Trump asked for patience for his trade policies that have resulted in new tariffs on American goods. No question that trade wars are now underway, most notably with China. Outrage has greeted his approach, but is the president wrong in his reasoning? While some disagree with U.S. tactics in taking on China in a trade war, some experts say the underlying arguments for doing so have legs. With us to talk about this, Raj Bala is a distinguished professor of law at the University of Kansas. He's also a senior advisor for Denton's law firm and a columnist for Bloomberg in India. Raj, so good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Annika Merriles is a reporter with a Missouri Business Alert, a business news publication from the University of Missouri. Annika, nice to have you.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, Annika, the president is calling for patience here. Is he going to get that from the farmers you're talking to?
I guess that sort of depends on your definition of patience. We could talk about voter support, looking at poll numbers, or we could talk about the farming season and how farmers really need things to turn around when they're dealing with things like lower commodity prices due to tariffs, as well as Missouri's drought.
How much worry is out there in farm country? What are you coming across?
I think there's a significant amount of concern. Definitely soybeans are a big deal in the state of Missouri, and soybeans prices dropped around $2. And that's a really big deal in terms of Missouri exports. Missouri exported $1.26 billion worth of soybeans in 2016. So certainly farmers groups are expressing some strong concern.
Professor Balla, when we talk about patience here, how much patience is going to be required?
A lot of patience if the United States wants to achieve its strategic objectives with respect to China in the Sino-American trade war. The U.S. has made clear that its strategic objectives include a structural change in the Chinese industrial policy known as the Made in China 2025 policy. And it's quite an alarming policy. For example, it lays out market share targets. For instance, that by 2025, at least 40% of the chips used in Chinese smartphones have to come from China. Or to bring it a little closer to home, by 2025, 95% of all the agricultural equipment used by Chinese farmers have to be made in China by Chinese firms. That is, in the administration's view, a national security threat.
So I was going to say, it's this threat that has captured your attention. Is that the center of why the administration is pushing back so hard here?
I think so. I think so. It's, you know, we lawyers try and differentiate cases, and there have been several different actions that the administration has taken dating back to January of 2018. And they've used different statutory authorities for them. This particular one, known as Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974, targets specific acts, policies, and practices of an individual foreign government, here China. And those acts, policies, and practices are said to be unfair, unjust, unreasonable, and that they burden or they restrict U.S. commerce. And the administration is not the first to use it. There have been about 100 cases since 1974 brought under Section 301. And it's different from the steel and aluminum tariffs. Those are different statute, different cause of action, if you will.
Why don't we hear more about this aspect of the trade war policy that you've written about, this notion that China wants to dig deeper and establish a firmer foothold in any number of products that are exported around the world? We hear about unfair trade policies. We hear about other aspects of this, but not so much what you're talking about.
Well, and here's again why I'm very grateful for your program. We do need to hear more about it. International trade law and policy is a difficult, technical, and complicated subject. It involves economics, policy, and politics, and philosophy. In this case, we're even getting into Communist Party ideology as against capitalist ideology. So it's a fascinating area, but it takes time to study.
Raj, I want to circle back to a comment you made initially here this morning about this need for patience. I'm wondering, are we talking weeks, are we talking months, or are we talking years?
I think businesses and consumers need to hope for the best but expect the worst, which means they need to start planning for years. They need to start planning for fundamental changes in the global supply chains of companies that go into China, maybe looking at those companies going to other countries, say India, Indonesia. I think consumers need to brace themselves for 10 to 25% increases in the costs of their goods that they're consuming in their local stores. One reason I say that is because the administration has signaled that it is willing to spend up to $12 billion in farm subsidies to help farmers that are hurt by Chinese counter retaliation. And those farm subsidies would be paid out through the end of this year, through December 2018. So we're talking at least multiple months. So I think it is time to start doing some strategic long-term planning.
But Raj, the administration has not laid the political groundwork for a war that might last years here. The inference from the president is something far more short term. The American people are not a patient people, Raj.
Well, I would say that the administration is probably making a political calculation that it's best to start small. Let me give you an analogy, which is maybe not the best one, but if we had been told in March 2003 that the Iraq War would last longer than it did, there would have been a lot greater opposition to it. So usually when you're launching a war, you don't want to say that this is going to take years.
Annika, as you talk to farmers around Missouri and elsewhere, this notion that a trade war might last years, what kind of reaction are you going to get to a statement like that?
I think that that's something that's really difficult for people to deal with. Agriculture is a main driver behind the economies of Missouri and Kansas. Agriculture companies contributed $2.2 billion in state and local taxes in Missouri in 2016. This is a far-reaching aspect of our economy that, you know, reaches into all these different industries and has such broad effects that I think a long-term trade war is just something that's really hard to even consider right now.
We're talking about tariffs. We're talking about trade. If you want to join our conversation with a great question, we'd like to have you. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. You can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Annika, tell us about the situation facing the Mid-Continent Nail Corporation in Poplar Bluff, Missouri, down near the Boot Heel. What did you find there?
So the Mid-Continent Nail Corporation, after the tariffs were enacted, their sales plummeted, and they had to lay off 100 workers. And they've even said that they might be forced to close the plant altogether. Mm. So this is a really dire situation that a lot of people have pointed to as, you know, one of the first effects that people are seeing of the steel tariffs in Missouri.
But why did this happen so quickly? I mean, it seems like the wars have only just begun. Why such a quick response in terms of layoffs and this threat of an actual shutdown?
Well, you know, we have other areas of the economy where different things have happened because of just where companies are in relation to the tariffs. So since Mid-Continent Nail is in a position where they're using steel, they're in a position to be on that side of the tariffs where they're going to be affected very quickly. Other companies, for instance, President Trump spoke at Granite City Works, which is a plant in the St. Louis area.
Right.
And they talked about how they're going to be restarting two blast furnaces and hiring back about 800 people. They're on the other side, so they're producers, so they're going to be benefiting right now from increased prices at the moment.
And what's happening, Annika, to a big Missouri export, soybeans? What are you seeing there?
So soybeans are a really central cause of concern for people right now. And so we're seeing a lot of concern about commodity prices dropping because of the tariffs. But we're seeing this also happen at a moment where Missouri is experiencing a drought. So we kind of have these two things happening
Yes.
at the same time that have a lot of people concerned. And partly it's an issue, too, where it's one situation if the entire soybean producing region is affected the same way by the drought, if all of the states are affected similarly. In a similar way.
So but, right, farmers are essentially facing a double whammy out there right now.
Yeah, exactly. And Missouri is being, you know, significantly affected by the drought. So it's kind of a different situation where we're being hit hard economically right here because it's not the same situation for the drought across the entire soybean producing region.
Professor Balla, you say that President Trump has laid out a strong and compelling case for his trade policies and the tariffs that go with them. What brought you to that conclusion?
Well let me be careful there. I said that the Section 301 action, based on the U.S. Trade Representative's report and the White House report, those two individual reports taken together.
These were very detailed,
very
comprehensive
detailed.
Kinds of reports that, again, maybe the general public isn't all that aware of.
Exactly, exactly. They're on the USTR and the White House website to look at. Those reports are pretty persuasive and well documented. On the other hand, the steel and aluminum tariffs brought under a different statute, which we call Section 232 of our 1962 Trade Expansion Act. Those have not taken the view that they are well justified. In fact, the best evidence is that they do not. The steel and aluminum imports do not threaten our national security. I mean, to be even the Defense Department was against the 232 steel and aluminum tariffs. Look, we import only about 4% of steel from China. Most of the steel and aluminum that we get comes from Canada, Korea, you know, and many allied countries. But to pick up on your point and on the point that Annika was making, already China has stopped buying soybeans and other products from the United States and is looking to diversify its sources, say, to Brazil or other shippers of soybeans. And likewise, many other countries are looking at the tariffs that American products are facing going into China. And those other countries, the likes of Brazil, Argentina, et cetera, are saying, well, we can step up potentially and fill the gap that is going to be created by the removal of the Americans from the Chinese market. And that's also very worrying.
I was going to say, Professor, as you're talking here, I can't help but think, again, I've covered politics for way too much of my lifetime here, but the political impact in a state like Missouri, once these farmers begin to reel here, and if the pain endures for years, potentially, as you suggest, you can't help but wonder if there won't be some sort of mass revolt against these policies and this president.
Well, the hope is that the agricultural interests in both Missouri and Kansas would themselves look for new markets. India, Indonesia, Malaysia, countries in South America that are growing and that have rising new middle classes. I mean, in fact, there's a silver lining here. China ages out, right? I mean, China is one of the most rapidly transforming demographic countries in the world. Older people tend to consume more of healthcare services, but less of the regular goods that we're used to in, you know, foods and other commodity items. I mean, of course, they still do some of that. But what your big new markets for agricultural and industrial goods are going to be in countries that have rising emerging class middle classes, and that's India, that's Indonesia, that's Brazil. So the farmers would want to look to those anyway, eventually, given China's long-term demographic profile.
What are the prospects for establishing trade with those nations when it comes to soybeans, at least in the short term?
The short term, it's difficult. But here in the medium and longer term, that's where the trade promotion efforts of the government is important. I mean, there are many groups, chambers of commerce, World Trade Centers, the state and local commerce departments that help, that do trade missions. I was just at one that the World Trade Center sponsored here in Kansas City on doing business with Ukraine, that try and put our interests together with the foreign markets and try and build those connections.
Let's go to a phone call here at 816-235-2888. Kevin from Kansas City, Missouri. Kevin, you're on the air. We're talking about tariffs and trade. Good morning.
You bet. Great show. Thank you so much. And great to have you back, Steve.
Thanks, Kevin.
Absolutely. On this, it seems extremely important to keep two other facts and financial facts in mind right now, too, with this Congress and with this administration. We just hit a $21 trillion debt, which we've never had in the history of the nation, thanks to our policies. And the debt has gone up 84% in the last year, in the last 12 months. Two huge factors when discussing everything financial in the United States right now.
What about the concerns over debt, Professor?
Well, there's the national debt, and that's to be distinguished from the deficit, and there are different deficits. There's the budget deficit, then there's a trade deficit, and a lot of concern is focused on the trade deficit itself. But I think most people agree, most economists and lawyers who study it agree that the trade deficit is caused by the long-term low savings rate and low investment rate in the United States. Not by any one or combination of trade policies, and tariffs aren't going to solve the trade deficit policy. It's rather incentives through the fiscal and tax system to encourage more savings and more investment that'll offset that or change that trade deficit around.
Annika, I was wondering, the president has released this plan to provide $12 billion in aid to farmers that's been mentioned here to offset the pain of this trade war. What kind of reaction have you gleaned that this idea is getting out there?
So I guess I would say what I've seen so far is that farmers organizations are telling me that farmers would really rather just not have the tariffs at all. And there's kind of a nature to the way that things are happening right now where there are these really abrupt announcements and changes. And when farmers, you know, have already invested in their crops before all this has happened and then things start to change really quickly, that just becomes really frustrating and really, I would say, anxiety producing.
Do they have much confidence that this money is actually going to help them out? Will it trickle down to family farmers and maybe even some larger scale operations?
I guess I would say that it's kind of difficult to say at this point.
Right.
I would say that people have been referring to this, though, as sort of a short-term solution. People haven't really talked about this yet as a long-term solution to the issues that farmers are facing with the tariffs.
You know, Annika, I haven't asked you about how this trade war is going to affect the Kansas City area. What have you picked up on that front?
There are a lot of different industries in Kansas City that are likely to be affected. The Kansas City area has two auto plants that are significant, Ford in Lake Como and General Motors in Kansas City, Kansas. And these are well-paying jobs, and Ford and GM have both warned the president that tariffs could lead to loss of these jobs.
Professor, how have other countries responded to what the U.S. is doing here? What are you picking up from the worldwide vantage point?
Well, again, to differentiate the cases, on the steel and aluminum
right.
Tariffs, it's been pretty much across the board negative. That is to say, seven countries have sued the United States in the World Trade Organization. U.S. has not gotten any support for those steel and aluminum actions. On the 301 China intellectual property action, there the European Union and a number of countries have said, yes, we agree with the substance of your concerns that China is misappropriating or sometimes outright stealing intellectual property. But we don't agree with the approach that you're taking. We don't like the idea of tariffs. Now, the U.S. has come back with that to that and said, look, what other choice do we have? We have tried suits against China in the WTO ever since China joined the WTO mm-hmm. in 2001. Those suits have been marginally effective. But now we are talking, the U.S. says, about claims against China that are simply not covered in the WTO agreements.
Mm-hmm.
The WTO court doesn't have jurisdiction over Chinese cyber attacks or forced technology transfer through joint ventures. So the U.S. says we have to try something different. Also, to your question, individual countries are taking steps against diversion of trade. For example, Canada and India are worried, understandably, that trade exports from the U.S. to China will get diverted away from China because of the Chinese tariffs and will get sent to their markets, possibly dumped in the legal sense of the word, in places like Canada and India. So they're starting to think about raising their barriers to products as a defensive measure. And that's where the cycle of trade, retaliation, counter-retaliation, counter-counter-retaliation, all
yeah.
these defensive measures really rises.
So give us your bottom line, Raj. Is this fight worth waging now, or are you wincing as you look at what the administration is doing?
Not to play lawyer too much, I think the 301 fight is worth waging, but I would
the
like—
The 301 fight being—
The China, the Sino-American
right.
trade war. Mm-hmm. I think that one on the Made in China 2025 industrial policy, I think this is a defining moment in Sino-American relations. I think it is that, but I'd like to see that resolved diplomatically. And when I say that, what I mean are some specific steps to deal with underlying structural problems like overcapacity in the Chinese industrial sector. We're not seeing any steps like that. The steel and aluminum tariffs, I mean, my own personal view is I think that would be better off settled rather quickly rather than going through 3+ years of WTO litigation.
John from Freeman, Missouri. John, you're on the air.
Hello, Steve. I just want to do a little math.
Yes.
There's about 2 million farmers in the United States. $12 billion divided by 2 million is 6,000. That's not even a percent of most farmers' gross revenue.
Okay.
Nothing.
Okay. A little perspective there. I appreciate that, John. Thanks for the good call. Appreciate it. Yeah.
Bye.
And we're going to have to leave our conversation there. What an interesting discussion this has been, offering some new context to this whole issue. I want to thank Raj Bala, again, as Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Kansas. Professor, thank you very much for your time. Sure appreciate it. Annika Marilise is a reporter with Missouri Business Alert, a business news publication from the University of Missouri. She joined us from the studios of KBIA this morning. Annika, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Tomorrow, the art world is still largely curated by white gatekeepers. We'll find out why that happens and what implications a lack of racial diversity brings to the art world. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, Dallas Johnson, and Emily Park. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.